make a big noise playing in the street. Gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place. Singing,
we will rock you. We will rock you.
Buddy, you're a young man.
All right, Record Store Day is this Saturday, April 13th. Now, what is Record Store Day, do you ask? It was conceived in 2007 at a gathering of independent record store owners and employees as a way to celebrate and spread the word about the unique culture surrounding nearly 1,400 independently owned record stores in the U.S. and thousands of stores internationally. Now, the day brings together fans and artists in the celebration of records, including this year's new and special music releases by Bob Dylan, David Bowie, the Foo Fighters, Prince, Sly and the Family Stone, Weezer, and many more. And joining us to talk about this big day is Rick Wojcik. He's the proprietor of Dusty Groove in Chicago. Hey, Rick.
Hi, how you doing?
I am good. Thanks for staying up with us tonight. You know,
sure.
I've been at Dusty Groove over on Ashland, and I have to say, this idea that you had for this record store, and it was really an online thing at first, it was like 25 years ago, and it was just a hobby.
Right, it was. I mean, this was back during the CD era, and we knew people still wanted vinyl, so we said, let's open a vinyl record store. And we did it on the internet because we also knew there were people all over the world that wanted American records, you know, and maybe in Chicago it wouldn't have flown entirely right from the start, but online we just took off immediately.
How does one start that hobby? Because did you have a massive collection of your own over the years, Rick?
Well, eventually, yes. I mean, it wasn't like I sat down and said, hey, I want to just have too many records to live with, but... I just love music, and I still do. I mean, that's the great thing about my job. You just, you know, records just turn you on to so many different things, and there's never a day that goes by that I don't stumble upon another record I haven't heard or something I thought I knew about, but I put it on, and my mind is blown. And, you know, I was that way as a young kid and just kept buying records, and then eventually, you know, was selling a little bit here and there, but, you know, kind of made it official with Dusty Groove.
What were some of the record stores you went to when you were a kid?
Oh, my gosh. You know, there were record stores in every corner. You know, I mean, it was just crazy. I mean, you had Rose Records downtown Chicago, which at one time was the largest record store in the world. You know, I used to buy records at Marshall Fields, had a great record department. And there were so many suburban ones, J&R Music, Record Discount, Discount Records, I'm sorry, Haywish Records, Record Swap, Beverly Records was on the south side. I mean, you know, I could talk for 2 hours and probably not finish. You know, Wax Trax was one of the most important
stores
to me when I was a kid.
Me too.
And they're actually putting out this new movie in conjunction, you know, with the event. They're having a big Wax Trax event on Record Store Day Eve, which I'm really happy to see them finally get credit for everything they've done.
Now, I worked on the retail side in the music business as well. It was like from 84 when I was in high school till 95 when I had worked at the music line over on Forest Preserve Drive over there. But, you know, I went to Rolling Stone. I went to Rose. I went to Camelot. You're absolutely right. The list, Valhalla, the list is absolutely endless. But then I also worked corporately, like for music line up in Minneapolis and Sam Goody and Transworld, when you used to own Peaches and Coconuts and all those guys as well. Do you remember what a phonolog was?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, you walked in, and if you were interested in a certain record, you know, they would look it up in this thing, and it had all the information. They could order it if you wanted, but now this is something that everybody remembers. Rose Records downtown, again, this was a giant multi-level record store. They filed all the records on the floor by catalog number. And if you wanted a record, you didn't come in and say, I want a Bob Seger record and go to the Rock Estate. They looked it up in this book,
I know, it's crazy.
And then they found it numerically on the floor for you, which was just crazy. But, they, you know, that's how many records were being sold back then, that it was easier to do it that way than put them out the way most of us know.
There was no computers. That was our computer.
Right.
I will tell you, from anybody that I still talk to that worked with me in that store, they hated that book because you'd get this stack, like an inch thick every week of pages that you had to replace and go through the book. Now, this is going to sound kind of crazy, but it was about 8-9 years ago, I bought on eBay what was the last filled book from 1995, a phonolog. So I have a phonolog sitting upstairs, and every time someone that worked with me sees it, they're like, I hate that thing. Because it was just, but to us who really knew what it was for, I mean, it was everything. It was the encyclopedia of every piece of music that was ever produced.
That's very true. That's very true.
Yeah. The store was a big hit. Within months, you were expanding. Fast forward to 2011. You've been at 1120 North Ashland ever since. Rolling Stone named your store number 3 record store in America. That happened pretty quick. Nice to be recognized.
Yeah, we've been lucky. I mean, I think it's one thing about selling online, too. It really helps us kind of cross-pollinate with the national reputation and being a local retailer. So it's great. And yeah, we've gotten, I mean, Time Magazine, The New York Times, Reader's Digest, Wall Street Journal, they've all given us some kind of ranking like that over the years. And, you know, that really helps a lot because it's a very tough business, as you can imagine. It's not like it once was, and helping guys like us get out there and remind people that we offer something really different than iTunes is very important to us.
Now, Rick, around that time, and I love the story, and I found an article online about this, because I knew this back then, because it's about the time that I started with WGN Radio, is we sat here at WGN Radio on one of the region's, one of the best preserved and most sprawling collections of vinyl records for decades in the Tribune Tower. And I remember one of the previous GMs and my friend Tom Langmeyer taking me back to that area. There was a card catalog. It felt like it was like a mile long.
Probably was. I mean, hundreds of thousands of cards typed out, with every artist, every catalog number, everything, all the songs on all the LPs, all the flip sides on all the singles. It was just, and that's the way they did it in the old days,
Well, it was like a library. You walk behind the secret kind of wall, and here was this treasure trove of music. And I know when we were moving upstairs at the time, it couldn't move one more time. Like, we weren't using it as much anymore. I know it surprises a lot of people that WGN played music at one time, but, we were on the air for 95 years. FM radio didn't come about really in a big way till the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, that's where you came to listen to new music. You listened. WGN was one of those stations.
Well, and even once WGN became all talk, the music was still very important for, punctuating things, for using as examples. All the DJs were still using it, even when we bought the record collection. And one of the things that had just happened in that time is that it became so much easier, digital production tools being what they were, for you guys to use sound samples rather than put on a physical record.
Right.
So, here was tens of thousands of records. I think there were about 50,000 LPs and 50,000 7-inch singles, literally like 50 feet from the front door of the Tribune building on Michigan Avenue, occupying valuable real estate, that most people didn't even know, was that close to ground level.
Right, exactly. You bought nearly half the collection. And how did that all come about? Did you just come down and start kind of piling through and seeing what we had? Were you surprised?
There were a bunch of us, and we were all taking looks. And there was a lot of damage and a lot of, things that happen when records are stored in radio stations. They had a lot of tape and writing. There were other things. There was warpage. So we had to go through and really kind of assess what kind of shape a lot of the stuff was in. And that was probably the lengthiest part of it. But one of the things that was very cool, and we've actually bought a number of radio station collections like this, is that all these radio stations used to get records for free.
Right.
And they wouldn't play all of them. If they were a country station, they might still get psychedelic records. And, those would be sitting there untouched. Or if they were a rock station, they might still get soul records. And, those would be untouched. So that was one of the things that was super interesting, was seeing that WGN had gotten all these weird and unusual records, a lot of which weren't hits at the time, but which have gone on to become legendary because they were years ahead of their time. And those were the coolest records of all, and really the records that, even WGN back in the day wasn't even doing anything with, but they were sitting on them, which was great.
But you had you bought like 20,000 LPs, 40,000, 45, several thousand CDs that must have expanded your inventory very quickly.
Well, I'm not downplaying the deal. It was very, we do this kind of thing a lot. We buy a lot of really big collections. You'd be amazed at her. I mean, the crazy thing is there's a lot of private collections that are bigger than that, in people's homes, their basements, things like that. And I've been doing this myself for almost 30 years in various capacities. And what I see out there, it still never ceases to amaze me. I mean, people just have this fantastic ability for bringing music to them, collecting it in a way they like, and holding on to it until they're ready to let it go.
Now, Record Store Day, which I absolutely love, has been going on for over 10 years already. And, explain to folks what that means. Like, you go into a vinyl store and you go into Dusty Groove on Record Store Day. What can they expect? There's a lot of cool things that are happening.
Yeah, you know, one of the great things is every store does something different, and everybody has their own way of handling it. I mean, the core part of the day is that they put out these records that are, by a strict set of rules, available only in-store, only first come, first serve, only one copy per customer, and they come out all on that same day. And that means that everybody starting at 8 in the morning, you know, gets a chance to sell those records, but they can't put them on eBay. They can't, you know, we can't even put them on our website until 24 hours have elapsed. And then after that, you know, you can do that. But during that time, there's this tremendous camaraderie. You wouldn't think it, but these crowds of people waiting in line, talking about music they love. We have people that start lining up the night before. I usually get there about 5 in the morning, sometimes 4 in the morning. You start giving out bagels, donuts, coffee.
That's awesome.
We open the doors at 8 o'clock. We've all got all sorts of festivities. We give away lots of prizes. We've got a Wheel of Fortune. We have a magician that comes to entertain the crowds with clothes magic in the afternoon. A lot of kids come by. We're giving them toys, comic books, just, you know, anything like that. We have refreshments all day long. It's really kind of just a big celebration, and I think that's, you know, really in its best spirit what most of the stores do. They just say, hey, let's just welcome people in, let's give them a cup of coffee, let's give them a beer, let's give them a hot dog, you know, whatever they want to do. And it's just a way to kind of remind people that we're here. And I will say this, you know, I was skeptical about the event at first. I mean, we participated, but watching in the number of years it's been going on, how many new young people we get. We didn't have kids back then.
That's cool.
And now we're getting, I mean, you know, Dusty Groove has been around almost 25 years. We never had teenagers in the store. Now we have kids stopping in after high school, and that's great. And this event is one of the reasons why the profiles of the stores have gotten re-recognized and why younger generations have realized, you know, we offer an experience that's very different than listening to sound samples online and even, you know, even being in user groups online, because it's a very different thing to handle all of this music physically while you're talking to people about it, to check something out. And if you really like something, bring something really special into your environment. I mean, that's very different than just grabbing it for free online.
My daughter's 13 years old and got her a record player a couple years ago, and that was probably her most asked gift. She got like 6 different albums for Christmas at 13. Great. And you know, some kids get it, some kids don't, and at a young age you got to kind of expose them to that stuff. You know, we have a jukebox and stuff, so they see a needle on vinyl all the time in my house, but it's great to expose these kids. I absolutely agree to this, and there's a lot of really contemporary stuff and new bands and local bands that are put out, of course, on vinyl. But on this special day, I was looking at just some of the names on here, from Madonna to John Lennon, Janis Joplin, the Woodstock. It's 50 years old this year, so there's a Woodstock double LP. Blues icon Robert Johnson, Wynton Marsalis. I mean, the list is really endless, but there's something for everyone.
Well, some of the best are, you know, and you're mentioning a lot of names of people who are A, dead, and or B, you know, sort of super famous, and you think, oh, I know all this stuff. And, you know, some of the best things I've come up with are these, you know, things that were just laying in the vault that, you know, Warner Brothers, Sony, Universal, all these places that, you know, suddenly they're able to put out these records, you know, and this event gives them a chance to do something they weren't ready to do before. And it's just great because the amount of unreleased stuff, the amount of, you know, genius stuff that we've heard from, you know, in this event has just been fantastic over the years. And I think one of the other things we've seen is it's reminded the record companies that we're all still really interested in doing this kind of thing all the time, because, you know, now they're putting this stuff out in the middle of the year. They're doing it, you know, they do things at Black Friday. I mean, it's kind of reminded the record industry as well that we're all still here and that we've all got a market for their titles, too.
There's a generation that clearly understands, including mine, that walking into a record store on a Friday night out with buddies, you'd spend an hour in there, 2 hours, just kind of walking through music, because it was all artwork, first of all, at the time. Big enough to be really called artwork, but that was the thing that you did over the weekend, as you went and spent time at record stores. It's funny that you mentioned Marshall Fields. I actually think I got my first vinyl LP at Marshall Fields on State Street in their record department. They had a huge record department up there. But there's so many, and you actually pay a lot of tribute to them on your website as well, some of these classic record stores, and you're asking for more, like, hey, give me your memories, and then come in my store.
Yeah, well, we just started that, and we really want to keep doing more of that. It's we call it the Chicago Record Store Project, and it's our way of remembering all these great record stores that were long gone. And sometimes it's tough tracking down the right people and getting the right information. But, you know, we've got a section where we've got information on the stores, photos. Yeah, we really only have about a dozen up now, but, you know, we really want to just try to include as many people as we can because, you know, everybody remembers the great record companies and the great artists, and even in some cases like the Fillmore, the Regal Theater, the Apollo, the famous venues. But the record stores were just as important in helping get that music out there. And this is our way of trying to get some of that, you know, in front of people's attention. Hopefully, you know, we'd love to do a much bigger job on it. But we're kind of doing it between everything else we do, which is working, you know, a million hours a week. But that's
right,
fine.
Right. Absolutely, because you love what you do. You were mentioning Wax Trax, and I always remember that was kind of a big deal, coming down a little deeper mm-hmm. in the city and exploring a really unique collection. And you talked about this new documentary. It's called Industrial Accident, the Story of Wax Trax Records. And they're touring the film with special events, with live performances by Ministry and Cold Cave, and a panel discussion that you're participating in. I think it's at House of Vans, Chicago?
Yeah, that's at House of Vans. It's the evening of Record Store Day. Tickets will only be available if you buy. There's a special Wax Trax record that's coming out Record Store Day, and it's a number of us, like Beverly Records, Reckless, Dusty Groove, you know, a number of other stores will have the record. And if you buy the record, you get tickets to this event, which isn't open to the public. But then the next Tuesday, the movie finally comes out on DVD, and it's really fantastic. I mean, this is a record store that influenced a city and had such ripples that went, you know, they made their own music, they influenced all these other artists, and all of that is just, they did a fantastic job with the documentary, and it's all going to be there. And it's, you know, if anybody who's interested, not just in the store, but in, you know, the Chicago, you know, its relationship to punk rock, industrial music, dance music, and all the many strands that Wax Trax touched on, you know, it's a pretty fascinating film.
And you have that, and of course, you're open to the public every day, 10 to 8 o'clock. People walk in there all the time. You can't only find great things in there, but you also buy stuff, too, still.
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, you know, I travel the country looking at record collections. I mean, we're all over the place. I mean, we buy not just from Chicago, but, you know, we travel to both coasts. And, you know, when I said that the size of collections would amaze you, you know, I'm not kidding. I mean, we really, you know, we buy and sell thousands of records a week. It's a pretty big business for us. So, and the records are still out there, and it's great. And equally great is meeting the people who buy the records and have collected them, because, you know, they're fascinating, and hearing how they connected with the music and hearing what's important to them. That teaches me a lot about the music that I wouldn't get just from the records themselves. And that's kind of a whole extra layer that, you know, I find really enjoyable about my job. It's the level of record history, that the listenership, the audience is, that, you know, is something that doesn't always make the history books, but which is really important.
Yeah, and it's because you love what you do. That's why you're having fun.
I do, yes.
Very good. Well, again, Dusty Groove is on 1120 Ashland Avenue in Chicago, and at dustygroove.com. And this Record Store Day, there's a lot of fun things happening, so make sure you swing by, say hello to Rick, and check out what he's got in there. And I really do appreciate you taking a little time and hanging out with us tonight. I know you got a busy week ahead, but in advance, happy Record Store Day to you, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks again. All right, news is next on 720 WGN. Most influential and respected instrumental rock guitarist on the planet, Joe Satriani is that rare musician's musician who crossed over into the mainstream, appealing to a wide variety of tastes. Joe worked as a guitar teacher in his early career with a number of his students, among them Steve Vai, Kirk Hammett from Metallica, Larry Lalonde, David Bryson from Counting Crows, Charlie Hunter, and countless others. Joe has toured with Mick Jagger, Deep Purple, and has truly pursued his own musical vision over the years through 14-plus albums, over 10 million sold worldwide, 15 Grammy nominations, and Joe, in my mind and millions of others, is one of the world's finest guitarists. And joining us to tell his story is Joe Satriani.
Hey, thank you very much for that amazing introduction.
Did I cover it all?
You covered it all. I was like hearing trumpets and violins in the background and kettle drums and everything.
Nice. I like that. Well, I'll tell you, I love the backstories, the very beginnings in someone's career. You know, you first picked up the guitar when you were 14. What brought you to want to play? What inspired you to play?
I used to think it was just like one moment, like hearing the first Hendrix song on the radio, that kind of thing. But part of the cathartic process of doing this book brought to light the fact that it was a lot of little things. You know, growing up as the youngest in a family with five kids who were all into music, and they were, you know, living through the 60s as I was just a little kid playing in the back of the room, sort of watching it all, inheriting all their records as they grew up and left the house. I was a drummer at age nine, and, you know, my older sister, not that much older than me, I've got three sisters, but she was a folk guitar player. I actually had proximity, you know, growing up with someone else in the family who played guitar. My older brother was also very musical. My mother played piano. So, you know, when I look back and I realize, wow, there was a lot of maybe not pushing and prodding, but I had a lot of influences early on. So I'm not sure it really surprised anyone in the family when I really stood up that evening and said, hey, you know, because Jimi Hendrix died, I'm going to be a guitar player, and I'm going to start right now, and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
Right. Well, you said you got a lot of your brothers and sisters' records. So out of what you were listening to, like, who inspired you? You mentioned Hendrix. Who else inspired you at that time?
Well, that period, third generation electric blues players, you know, Hendrix, Beck, Clapton, Page. I heard a lot of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Of course, Beatles and Stones were huge. There was a ton of Motown and soul music being played in my house. And, of course, those guitar players, they didn't really have a name and an image that that we knew about as much as, let's say, the rock guitar players who were being heralded as you know, guitar heroes at the time. On the jazz side, probably Wes Montgomery was my biggest influence. That was, you know, my parents' music. That's what they listened to. They were of the jazz age.
Sure.
But, you know, that's what I was listening to. And you know, I would play a lot of, Robbie Krieger stuff because we were into the Doors. We, as I said, a lot of Beatles and Stones. Tony Iommi, you know, the Black Sabbath, it was a very big influence. And Ritchie Blackmore, all the usual suspects that you would guess somebody from my generation would latch on to.
Well, you mentioned
they all be.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Well,
I'm saying that it's obvious they all became part of my musical roots, and that's kind of like where I built my style.
Well, you mentioned Jimmy Page, and in the book you talked about, you know, your dreams of being a Jimmy Page type guitar player in a traditional rock band, but at some point you redirected yourself to play solo and more instrumental music.
Yeah, you know, that didn't really come until I was, you know, an older, young adult, let's say. I'm living out in California, and I started to think that some of the music I was making at home, recording on a four-track, would be worth releasing. And it was stuff that I was doing for personal development. But if I go back to those, you know, the early 70s, starting in 1970, I was always in a rock and roll band that was trying to imitate Led Zeppelin or Black Sabbath or Deep Purple. That's what we always played. And we would swing into David Bowie and T-Rex because we were into that too. And I didn't, you know, although I spent some time studying bebop and really getting into the guitar playing of John McLaughlin and Alan Holdsworth, I've always just been a rock guitar kid from Long Island. You know, that was, I never forgot who I really was.
Yeah.
I never,
yeah.
that I,
never left me. So I learned classical music theory, I learned bebop, and these things just added to my core personality as a player.
Right, it brought everything together for you. I mean, from all the experiences and all the different types of music, I mean, it just kind of formed who you were, or who you are.
Yes, and you know, that's a very good observation, because what you point out is really, that's the story of a lot of players. If you were talking to Jimmy Page, he would tell you about all the kinds of music that he was growing up listening to, skiffle music, early rock and roll. And although we may not hear it in Led Zeppelin, that's actually what's, you know, the foundation of his style, all those early influences.
Now, your journey began with your 1986 album, It Was Not of This Earth, which I love the story. You funded it using a pre-approved credit card with a $5,000 credit limit. Obviously very determined to get this album made.
Yes. Is he crazy? Yeah, if anybody's listening to this part of the interview, do not follow this.
Why not? But I mean, that's a dream. You're following a dream, and you had a mission in your head that's, you know, that was your first album, and that's how you were going to get it done. Hook or crook, man, this is what you were going to do.
Oh, see, now, you haven't mentioned that the rate on that card was 19.8.
Oh, God.
I was killed by those fees, you know, and I was trying to pay it off slowly. But yes, it was a godsend, and it was kind of creepy, because that the day that card arrived, I had just gone around town trying to get what we call a spec deal, where studios and engineers will front you their time and energy, and then you pay them back once you get a deal. And of course they thought, well, you'll never get a deal, so forget about spec time. And I remember returning home sort of dejected, just thinking, you know, this is never going to happen. And I'm going through my mail, and lo and behold, there's this free credit card, you know. So I thought it was a sign from heaven, you know.
Yeah, man.
Man, you know, that kind of thing. So, but it did work out. But I, as I pointed out in the book, it was a rough road towards the end there. The album got done. And before I got involved with Relativity, and the album was sort of going to be put out on my own label, which was really just a shell of a company that I operated out of my apartment. Mm-hmm. I got saved by that Greg Kinn gig. Greg Kinn, you know, they were recording what became their last album on EMI. They had a nice big budget, but their guitar player had some health problems, and they called me that same week where I was about to default on that credit card debt, and said, hey, please help us out. Finish the album. If you hang out with us for another year, we'll pay you this great salary just to save us, you know, because we can't afford not to finish the record and go out on tour immediately. And it just fell in my lap, and it saved my economic situation.
It saved your economic situation, but was that tough for you to say, okay, you know, I kind of want to do this out on my own. It's you know, I just put out my album, but... Was it more about the economics? Was it okay for you? Did you feel okay about playing with another band?
I did, because it was the Greg Kinn band, and I knew Greg and Steve and the guys in the band for a very long time, because my local band, the Squares, had been opening for them for 4 or 5 years, and so we were very close to them. They were a local band. They had a huge success with that song Jeopardy.
Right.
And they had asked, I think about 3 years prior to that, they asked me to join the band, and I kind of said no, because I had my own band and I wanted to stay loyal. So it wasn't that far-fetched that I would say yes to Greg and Steve. And at the time, Pat Mosca was on keyboards and Tyler Ring was playing drums. It was actually a really good band, and Greg was really on the top of his game. He was just a born front man, a great rock and roll singer, and they were so easy to play with that it was actually a lot of fun. And then I could, like, exhale for a moment.
Right, and breathe a little bit. Man, you got such great stories. I want you to stick around. More with Joe Satriani next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to iconic musician, guitarist Joe Satriani. So we were just talking a little bit about the the Greg Kinn band, and it was also at a time that Mick Jagger reached out to you.
Yeah, boy, what a crazy turn of events. You know, it was January of 88. Actually, let me step back just about two more months. Surfing with the Alien gets released, my second record.
Mm-hmm. 87.
Relativity. And Barry Coburn, the president at the time, said, you know, we've released the record, not quite sure where it's going to go, but you should probably go out on tour. And I pointed out to him that I had never performed as an instrumental solo artist. I had no idea what to do. I said, I don't have a band. I don't even know what to do when you walk out on stage. I'm a guy who plays in a rock and roll band with a singer, you know. So he said, well, you better figure it out because, you know, we're going to sell in some of these things and you got to show up. So I begin to think, okay, I got to do something, you know. So I called these guys and that I had played with over the summer just for a NAMM show event in Chicago. So that would have been Stu Hamm and Jonathan Moover. And we kind of just were winging it. We really didn't know what to do. And we started this tour. It was going to be about 3 weeks. I think we started down in San Diego, but we wound up on the East Coast. I remember having a meeting with my tour manager, who pointed out that we were losing about $8,000 a week. And it was, you know, and like by the time I got home, I was screwed, you know?
Yeah, right, exactly. Oh, God.
Playing a show in Boston, freezing, you know, in like Chicago in early January. And all of a sudden I get this call from my friend who's working for Bill Graham Presents. And he says, hey, you know, we're putting on the Jagger tour, and they're looking for a lead guitar player. They've been through 50 guys, and they can't find the right guy. Do you want to audition? And I thought, oh, this is the funniest thing ever. Either a good joke, or I'm just going to say yes, just so I can meet Mick for 5 minutes.
It's fate, brother, because this has happened all throughout your career, at least your early career. I mean, this is exactly the path that you have been on.
It's, you know, this is the thing, these are the things that happen. It's like with Chicken Foot and so many episodes in my life. They just, out of the blue, these things happen. And so I did. I was actually going to be in New York anyway. We had four shows at the Bottom Line. They were sold out. And it was the only part of our tour that was actually a triumph, you know, was that New York City stay. And so I went a day early. I started the audition. Mick comes running in the room. He says, this sounds amazing. I love what you're doing. Let's keep going. And we were best buddies and we were having a great time. And he invited me to stay in the band. And, you know, what he didn't know, of course, was that I was looking at this Surfing with the Alien tour that was losing money, because even though the record was climbing up the charts, I had no story, as we say in the music industry.
Well, you were building it. You were building it now.
Yeah, so I wasn't really trusted by all the clubs and theaters around the world. So we couldn't get gigs, even though the record was really doing a lot of climbing up the Billboard charts. So this was a great place for me to take a break, to go back to being a guitar player in a band with a singer. And, you know, oh my God, what a singer.
Mick Jagger. I mean, it's Mick Jagger. I mean, that must have been surreal.
It was very surreal. And the coolest thing about it, and people ask me this all the time, but Mick was such a cool guy. He totally exceeded all expectations of, you know, what you might have meeting a famous person and an enormously popular musician. He just had more talent and more good stuff than I would have imagined, you know. And I was prepared to kind of think, you know, he's just a rock star, you know.
Yeah.
But he wasn't, and he remains a good friend, and he just continually blows me away. I saw him just a few months ago when they came through the Bay Area and played Oakland, and, you know, he's backstage, he's the same guy he was that I met back in 88, and on stage he was even better, you know, than I'd seen him sing years before. So that was such a great experience that year of doing those two very big tours with him in Japan and then Australia, New Zealand, Indonesia. Fantastic experiences for someone like myself. And he gave me freedom to you know, do what I wanted to do in the band. I was the lead guitar player reflecting all the lead players across his career. So I didn't really have to try to play like Keith Richards. He was always telling me to just be myself. And, you know, when I got back from that first tour, the surfing record had really taken off. And all of a sudden, I had this boost. Because I was with Mick, I was suddenly in Rolling Stone, the Wall Street Journal, this magazine. I was on MTV. You know,
it put you out there.
I was a struggling guitar teacher, you know, a few months earlier, and then all of a sudden, I wasn't. I was somebody people started to figure out how to pronounce my last name. I was impressed.
Well, I'll tell you, you mentioned being a teacher, though, but I mean, you taught, you know, the list of people that you taught is mind-blowing. Just Steve Vai to begin with, but, you know, Metallica's Kurt Hammett, Counting Crows' David Bryson, jazz fusionist Charlie Hunter, Larry Lalonde from Primus, Alex Skolnick from Testament, Kevin Cadogan from Third Eye Blind. Steve Vai, tell me how Steve Vai came to you and learned from you.
Well, this is such a great story. Steve and I go way back. We're just sort of like, you know, spirits connected at this point. I went to a public high school called Carr Place High School in the middle of Long Island in Nassau County. And less than a mile away from me is this other kid growing up, Steve Vai. And I think the first time that he heard about me was through his friend John Sergio, who was taking guitar lessons from me. He'd seen me play at a local high school dance or some parties. And when Steve asked him, I want to really get into guitar. I don't want to play accordion anymore. I want to play guitar. And he says, well, you got to go to my guitar teacher, you know. And so Steve literally showed up. I mean, I get it. You know, I hear my doorbell ring. I go down to the front door, and there's this kid holding a guitar in one hand with no strings on it and a pack of strings. And he says, oh, hi, I'm John Sergio's friend. Can you teach me how to play guitar?
Wow.
So I was just about, I think I was 15, maybe 15 going on 16 at the time. And I said, well, yeah, sure, why not, you know? And that was the beginning of a wonderful friendship. But also an eye-opening experience for me as a teacher, because at that time I was still teaching other kids who were all okay, but they were just your average beginners, just like I was, you know, struggling to learn how to play.
Sure.
But suddenly at this kid who was not ordinary at all. Steve was the kind of student that had everything figured out that you gave him last week just perfectly, you know, the following week. And I'd sit there and go, oh, my God, you actually learned the entire lesson. And, you know, after about 6 months, I was thinking, like, this kid's catching up to me so quickly. And that's what happened. After about a year or two, we became more like comrades, and I was turning over information that I had just learned a few months earlier to this student who really became my brother, you know, with my guitar brother. You know, that's the way that the relationship progressed. And the little funny fact is that the lead singer in my band had a younger brother who turned out to be the lead singer in Steve's band. And they took the name of our band and they spelled it in reverse. That was the way that they tried to copy us.
That's cool. How do you accept the student under your tutelage? Like, what's the process? What was that process for you? Did you have to see something in them? Did you, like, audition them? Did you sit down? Like, what was the process for you?
No, you know, I never auditioned students like that. I taught young kids that were my contemporaries. I taught little kids who may not have ever gone on to play guitar. I taught some what I called at the time grown-ups, you know, some of my teachers from school, friends of my parents who just wanted to learn how to play some songs on the weekends. I never discriminated against, you know, what kind of a student they wanted to become, whether they just wanted to be a casual player or they wanted to become, like Steve, the greatest guitar player in the world. And that continued when I moved to Berkeley, California, and I sort of got roped into teaching again. I thought, you know, I'm just going to do what I did before. I'm going to teach everybody, and they weed themselves out, because if they come back for a couple of lessons and they haven't practiced, they get so much crap from me. They just and leave in a huff, you know. And to me, that's the best way to weed out a student body, is let them leave on their own accord, because that shows, you know, that they're serious or they're not.
Well, you taught so many, but then here we got 14 solo albums, which, you know, still my favorite is The Extremist. That's still the album that's closest and dearest to my heart. Then Crystal Planet, I love the new album in 2013, Unstoppable Momentum. Before I let you go, I got to ask you, people have called you the guitar player's guitar player. What advice do you have for the next generation of musicians who see you as an inspiration?
Well, you know, I'm flattered. I always thought that the best thing you can do is, lead by example. And I still practice every day. I love playing guitar. I love music. I love being a musician. I think that all musicians out there really should, embrace the idea that your fans out there will always want to see you strive for excellence, and they want you to be original. So there's no point in trying to homogenize into the trend. Just strike out on your own, be original, whether you're with a band or you're a solo artist. Just get out there and play music for people, lift people's spirits. That's what they need from us.
Guitar legend Joe Satriani. Right after the news, we'll talk to iconic drummer Kenny Aronoff. Next on 720 WGN. So talent, energy, dedication, discipline, passion, innovation, education, drive, mind, body, spirit, vision, honor, truth, and drums make the man. And Kenny Aronoff, voted as Rolling Stone magazine's one of the greatest drummers of all time, is arguably the most sought-after recording and touring beatmaster ever. He's worked with the likes of John Mellencamp, Melissa Etheridge, John Fogerty, Bon Jovi, Stevie Nicks, Smashing Pumpkins, The Bodines, Paul Westerberg, Celine Dion, Elton John, Bob Dylan, Alice Cooper, Meatloaf, Joe Cocker, and countless others. And he's joining us once again tonight. What's up there, Kenny?
How you doing, man?
I am great. I was just sharing with you before we got started here that watching you play, it's, to me, it's art. I mean, it's absolutely, first of all, it's exhausting watching you play. It's exhausting, yeah. But it is absolutely amazing. I got to stand 5 feet away from you during a Bodines concert when you were in Chicago a couple years ago, and nothing short of incredible, my friend.
Thank you. That's awesome. Thank you. I'm glad you appreciate that.
Now
I don't choose to be that. Yeah. I mean, I choose to be that way, but I am wired that way.
Yeah.
And even last night, I wake up and I went to bed, slept 4 hours typically, woke up, went downstairs because I didn't want to wake my wife up, and then I started practicing on my legs some new techniques to add to my 30-minute routine I do that I call functional practicing. It's designed specifically to make me sound 3% better than I normally do if I do this 3 times a day.
Wow.
Every second is designed to work certain techniques out that I use every night when I play. So I'm not wasting any time. And I thought, man, I should really add this to it. And this is the way my brain works. So, yeah, when I play, it doesn't matter if it's an unsigned artist in my studio and nobody's watching, or if I'm playing at Obama's inauguration, or Kenny's in honors, or Fogerty, Bodine's, anybody, it's the same to me.
It is.
I've got to play perfect.
Absolutely. And, you've had quite a life. And when I first talked to you about 4 years ago, I thought to myself, this guy's got to write a book. And that's about as long, I think, that it took you to put this book together, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it took a long time. Not an easy task, and I didn't really want to do it because I had a feeling it was going to be a lot of work, and God, was I right. And, I'm busy enough as it is, and I now know why people don't write autobiographies.
Well, your first submission was almost 250,000 words, wasn't it, the first time you put it together?
I think it was 600 pages, and the contract's for 300.
Oh, God. So, that's a couple volumes right there, my friend. That's what that is.
And at one point, I literally had a checkbook in my hand, and I had Hal Leonard on the other line saying, "Listen, I'm ready to buy this book back and bury it. This book ain't happening." and just like a lot of great things, you get to that point, and I felt that I had already gotten interviews from John Bon Jovi, John Mellencamp, John Fogey, Melissa Etheridge, Billy Corgan. I mean, there was no turning back in a way, or I guess I could have buried it. But the point is, if it was going to come on, I had to make sure that it was decent, you know, and good. And well, I think we're there.
Well, I mean, and plus, it allowed you to reflect on this journey that you've had and really go back in detail, because I know you've kept calendars and weekly planners that documented every single session and every single gig that you've ever done. So to be able to walk through that step by step and relive it, it must have had a great impact on you.
Yeah, because I never look back. I don't even play the stuff I played on. It never is good enough to me. I mean, I have this phrase that I'll never be as great as I want to be, but I'm willing to spend the rest of my life trying to be as great as I can be. It's like being a running back. You don't score touchdowns every time, but you just keep trying. Anyway, that's just kind of the human condition, and I've accepted that, and that's cool. And that's what makes it possible for me to keep going, because I realize, you know, you're not going to be perfect. You're going to have bad days. You know, but the big picture is that I'm getting better and better still, and I love what I do. And, it's been, I had to look back and look to my life, and then that was definitely, wow, there's a lot of therapy in that.
Yeah, I bet.
I'll tell you this.
I bet.
I mean, it was like I had to relive a lot of stuff. It wasn't bad. It just took a lot of work. And then I asked myself, the big question I asked myself was, wait a minute, how did I do this? How did a little kid that, you know, saw the Beatles, that famous Ed Sullivan show, when I was 11 years old in 1964, the Beatles playing on the Ed Sullivan show, how did a little kid who saw that end up playing with the Beatles, honoring them for that show 50 years later?
Yeah.
How did that happen and all the stuff in between? And I answered it with, I came up with 7 ways I believe people can be successful and stay successful, because these are the same 7 ways that led me to have this extraordinary career in one of the most difficult businesses in the world, the music business, and it's for 35 years. I mean, I never asked myself that question before, and finally I answered it with 7 things, you know, that, you know, stuff like self-discipline, hard work, you know, communication skills, getting along with people, that's huge. Being able to execute a plan that reaches goals. Healthy life is a wealthy life. You got to be healthier mentally, physically, and emotionally, or everything.
I think that's one of the best stories cover to cover, though, reading this book, is knowing, you know, the influence that you had watching the Beatles on Sullivan. And then again, when the Beatles had their celebration, you know, you were playing on stage with Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. I mean, really, your life has come full circle.
I mean, what what a lucky break for me to have that, because that ended up being a great kind of way to bookend my book. I mean, I didn't plan that, but it sure is nice. What a way to, you know, it's basically, this is how it goes. Dreams come true, but not by accident.
Yeah.
I made them happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dreams come true, not by accident. I made it happen. Meaning, if I hadn't done those 7 things, worked my butt off and practiced, you know, always 8 hours a day whenever I had those opportunities, and bust my ass and never sit on my laurels, and even when I made it, I worked just as hard as I do now. That made it so that I was available in people's faces. So when it was time to have somebody do that show, they called me.
Absolutely. And they still call you. Yeah, and they still call you. And I know you were self kind of taught playing the drums. You grew up in Massachusetts, but you chose Indiana University. Tell folks why Indiana University.
Well, Indiana University was the number one school in America in classical percussion. And I did, when I was a little kid, there was nobody to teach me drums, so it was all new, this rock and roll thing. And I grew up in a little town of 3,000 people, so it was, you know, when we saw rock and roll, there was nobody to teach us, so I was self-taught. But the Boston Symphony Orchestra summer program, you know, I guess you guys have, like, Ravinia, right?
Right. Is that where you got it. Okay. And you've been there.
So we have a thing called Tanglewood. It was 3 miles from the house. I started taking lessons from the percussionist. And that guy, Arthur Press, directed me towards classical music. I started learning timpani, mallets, orchestral snare, reading, sight readings, music theory, you name it. And then my family all went to college, and so I couldn't get into Indiana University. I wasn't good enough. I went to UMass. And then that first year at UMass, I was not the best by a long shot, But I had started practicing 8 hours a day the summer after I graduated high school. I was partying. I was practicing because I was scared to, you know, go to as a freshman and be behind. Because I wasn't playing in concert band or orchestra and symphony band and marching band. I was a jock, and so I played sports, and I had a rock band. I was playing in clubs when I was 13.
The Alley Cats,
so why
right?
Why would I want to listen to a squeaky clarinet when I could be playing Led Zeppelin, the Beatles, James Brown, you name it. So anyway, in my freshman year, I tried, you know, it wasn't the best. I already was trying to leave UMass, and I went to Aspen School of Music, which is run by
Juilliard. Yeah.
Top three schools.
Sure.
And just really, I was chasing after this hot cellist. I heard she was going to audition. I got in. He didn't go. She bailed.
Oh.
I went. And that's where the teacher who taught at IU in Bloomington was teaching. And I completely was blown away by him. He was not just a good teacher, but he was a deep thinker. He was an extreme disciplinarian. I just knew it was good for me. So I demanded an audition up there to come to Indiana University. He tried to sway me to audition in January. I put my foot down and said, no, I want to come now. I auditioned. You had to have four different people from four different departments to audition in front of, and there were four different departments. Like up there in Austin, you had woodwinds, brass, vocals or piano, and then percussion. I auditioned, got in, spent 4 years in Bloomington.
Wow.
And all 4 years, that was the number one school in the country. And very, very hard to get into, but you had to work your butt off to stay in.
Kenny, you started a band called the Alley Cats. It was Beach Boys tunes, wasn't it?
Beach Boys and Beatles.
Beach Boys and Beatles. Pretty cool. And that was kind of where you first got your feet wet in your own band. And then in 1980... you joined John Mellencamp, John Cougar at the time.
Yeah, what happened was, I call it the American dream. You go to school, get a degree in something, and then you get a job in the field that you studied. I did. I got into the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra and Key to Ecuador, but I still wanted to be in the Beatles. My heart dominated, my passion dominated my intellect, and that was, I kept telling myself, you should do this orchestra gig, but I didn't want to. I'd rather play in a club playing rock and roll, rock, R&B, fusion music, making $75 a night, because that's really what I want to do. And so then I spent 4 years busting my ass, moved back to Indiana, had my own band. The idea was to get a record deal, get signed, make records, and tour. Didn't happen. And then I heard about this Johnny Cougar guy that lived in Bloomington, Indiana, of all things. Auditioned, got the gig.
And John's guitar player told you right off the bat, welcome to hell. More, which is, wow. Hey, thanks. Thanks, buddy, for the first. But referring to his rigorous rehearsal schedule, I mean, he was pretty tough.
Oh, it was great. I praise him for it. I mean, I think that the only way you can make it is from self-discipline and hard work. And John had us working from 11 in the morning to 5 at night, and then it did a break 7 to 11, 5 days a week, and it was like a business. And that's how we came from being a club band into a venue to eventually arenas, you know. And it just came from hard work. And the people that are lazy and feel self-entitled, you do nothing, you get nothing. It's like math.
So true.
Zero equals zero.
Yeah, man.
And we weren't that. We worked our asses off. And as we were making hits and being successful, we continued to do that. And I was already that guy anyway. Seeing that in rock and roll was really awesome, and I have used that business model to stay successful my entire life. And as you know, when John quit, I broke into session work, and I used that same business model to become successful at that. And, you know, I'm the book, I'm doing speaking engagements now. It's once you learn discipline, man, you can apply it to anything.
Absolutely.
Including raising a family.
Yeah, and you learn a lot, obviously, along the way as well. One of the great stories in this book, and you've got tons and tons of great stories in this book, playing with John. Tell us the story about behind Jack and Diane.
Well, Jack and Diane wasn't on the record because we didn't know what to do with it. It was a simple song. It had great lyrics. We all knew it was a cool song, but we weren't educated enough to know how to arrange it. So, we went... didn't work it out in the studio, in home, in a rehearsal place. which typically becomes a bigger problem in the studio. And we kept hearing this weird drum machine sequence pattern coming out of the room next to us in Criteria Studios in Miami. It was the Bee Gees, and they had this Lin drum machine, basically a drum machine, and it was playing the beat. They were trying to be hip and modern, too, because the whole disco thing was, you know, big.
Sure.
And so our engineer walked in with that once, and I was just mortified that I would be replaced by a drum
machine. Yeah, yeah.
So I just grabbed the thing from him and said, give me that thing. You know, if anyone's going to program it, I wanted to at least have my touch on it. So I did. I programmed the beat I was playing on a drum machine using different sounds. Instead of like hi-hat, I had tambourine on the Lin drum machine. And instead of kick drum, it was a pitch tom-tom. And then I went into the lounge and played pool, kind of all bummed out, you know, I'm being replaced by a drum machine. And, I mean, nowadays that's this common, but back then it wasn't that common. So I... then all of a sudden I hear John yelling, Aronoff, get Aronoff in here. And he said he wanted a drum solo. And I kept thinking, a drum solo? On a ballad, I was thinking...
Right. You know, I'm with you. I hear you. Yeah.
I was going, well, you know, I was into Buddy Rich and all these technique guys. And I went, God, what would Buddy Rich do? And I thought about it. I went, well, Buddy Rich would say, get rid of that damn song. It stinks. Can't solo on that. But that wasn't the case.
No.
So I basically, long story short, I was fighting for my job at that point. Two guys had been fired. It was a very tense situation making that record, and rightfully so. John felt like he was going to be dropped, and we did eventually get dropped, ironically, on that record, and that record won a Grammy in the end. So a great rock and roll story. But basically, I had to compose a piece of music. It wasn't really a drum solo. It was a piece of music that had hook lines and the rhythm that you could imitate, and people would air drum for the rest of my life.
It's a critical part of the song, absolutely.
Huge, man. It was huge, and it didn't come easy, but I did it, and I'm proud of it, and it launched my career, and, you know, I never thought that it was all done. When I finally that song went to number one, I was more afraid that it was number one than if it hadn't made it, because I thought, how can I do this again? Am I really number one? No. Like I said, I'll never be as great as I want to be, but I'll spend the rest of my life trying to be as great as I can be. And I didn't think I was number one at all. People are going to think I'm number one, but I'm not number one. What am I going to do next? How am I going to keep this going? So what do I practice? How do I get better, you know?
And you still do that, and I know that's how you still feel.
Yeah, I still feel that way.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah,
you know.
Now I know with John, you were on Saturday Night Live. You performed with the original "Not Ready for Primetime Players." You've been on Saturday Night Live multiple times, not only with Cougar Mellencamp, but with the Pumpkins, and I think Willie Nelson. Maybe was Willie Nelson or Paul Simon?
Willie and Paul Simon together. Yeah. Yep, six times I did. That's a great show. That's very live.
Yeah, it is. I'm sure it is. And then you played Farm Aid with John, which was the first time you also met John Fogerty, which also turned out to be a two-decade-long friendship, if not more.
Oh, man. Dude, I was rolling joints on Creedence Clearwater Records and, you know, thinking, God, that guy's voice is so amazing. And, you know, reading... Can I say joints on the radio?
You've said it a few times too, so I'm fine with that. It's late night. We're good with that.
Okay, good. So all you fans listening, I hope I didn't offend you. I won't say it again.
Not at all.
I'm so blessed. I'm so lucky. Somebody told me you're going to play with John Fogerty from Creedence Clearwater, the singer of Born on the Bayou. When I was 13 years old, listening to his stuff, I would have fainted. And so, yeah, playing with him has been one of the iconic moments of my life, you know? Unbelievable.
And then, you know, you started playing with the Bodines, which is how I've seen you and known you for the past 30 years, and in studio, too, here with Kurt. And then you got a call from someone asking if you would be interested in auditioning with a bass player of your choice for Mick Jagger. I mean, holy cow. Right. Do you want to, the question. Oh, yeah, sure. Why not?
Dude, I got that call. I would definitely, the adrenaline level went up. And I remember I was so pumped.
Yeah.
We got into SIR Studios where we were playing. I set up the drums. As soon as I got the drums set up, I started just getting this funky beat, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember the other guys all looking at me like, what are you doing? I mean, it's Mick Jagger, man. I'm like, I'm thinking, I don't care, man. I'm just laying this dude down. The Mick starts dancing, doing that rooster thing he does, you know.
Yeah, sweating. The energy,
and
right?
He likes it. And then we just did this song, and I got the gig, you know. Me and the bass player got the gig, but then I ended up not being able to do it because they kept changing the schedule, and I was booked with Mellencamp.
Dave Byer on 720 WGN. We're talking to one of the greatest drummers on the planet Earth, and that is Kenny Aronoff. Word started getting around, though, at that point that you could play absolutely anything. I mean, you know, top 40 to, you were playing, you know, mm-hmm. B.B. King and blues, Johnny Cash and country, yeah. Alice Cooper, mm-hmm. Elton John. And, you know, the record labels at that time, it was a different world. So, I mean, they'd fly you all over the place to play.
Yeah, man, that's the truth. That's why I was able to live in Indiana for so long, because they'd just fly me anywhere. Everybody knew me at the airport. I'd show up with two cases of snare drums, and I had two kits in L.A., two in Nashville, one in New York, or two in New York, and I had one in Japan, one in Germany. I'd just fly everywhere, make records. I think one two-week period was rehearsed with Fogerty for his first tour in 20 years to play Creedence songs from 12 to 6, from 7 o'clock until 11 at night. I was working with Roy Bittan from Springsteen's band. He was producing artists. And from midnight until 6 in the morning, I was recording with the Rolling Stones. And on the weekend, Bon Jovi.
Wow. Now, I was going to say, and I'm going to embarrass you a little bit because the list is endless. And I mentioned just a few of them in the beginning of the interview, but just looking at the stories from this book, The Smashing Pumpkins, Bob Seger, John Fogerty, Melissa Etheridge, Joe Cocker, Willie Nelson, Michelle Branch, Styx, The Goo Goo Dolls, The Bodines, Ringo, Dr. John, Greg Allman, The Stones, Smashing Pumpkins, Springsteen, Ringo, Bob Seger, Melissa Etheridge, John Bon Jovi, Elton John, Bob Dylan, Rod Stewart, Steven Tyler, Dave Grohl, Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, Sheryl Crow, Ray Charles, Alice Cooper, B.B. King, Bonnie Raitt, Santana, Patti LaBelle. I mean, look at this stuff. It's just the list is overwhelming, Kenny. I'm going to tell you.
It's crazy, I know. It's crazy. You know, the thing is, when I look back, I don't pay attention to that stuff. All I'm thinking is like, well, what am I doing next week? It's over. It's not. I got Billy Gibbonson coming up, a Paul Simon thing coming up. I've got Fogerty thing coming up, Bodine's coming up, and I've got I'm leaving Sammy Hagar thing coming up in Milwaukee. And, I mean, it's just, I just...
Your energy's amazing, man.
I'm very fortunate. Well, I take care of myself, you know.
You've played on Grammy specials. You talked about presidential inaugurations, Kennedy Center honors, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and with Paul Schaefer. And I know you filled in, actually, with Paul on the CBS Orchestra when Letterman was still on the air.
50 times.
Wow.
And the first time was great because I'm like flying from Japan. I did some big special out there while I was playing with everybody. Anyway, I got flying, and the first day I'm on the show, I mean, it's like you have to learn the theme, and there's all these like the rehearsals for 30 minutes, and you have to come up with all this walk-on music, walk-off music. Paul's got a list of 350 songs. I narrowed it down to 30. And he'd say, okay, well, we'll bring this on. There's all these cues and blah, blah, blah. And I'm nervous. And we get through the theme, and we get through walking somebody on. And then all of a sudden, this guy walking on is doing his stupid human tricks. And I'm looking at my notes, and I'm nervous. And I'm sweating. I'm like, God, I'm almost done. And Dave says, what are you going to do? He said, well, I'm going to do a handstand. There's a mirror under the gym. And you tie a yo-yo to my toe, and I'm going to yo-yo. And David goes live on the air, goes, Anton, get up here. He says, oh, wait, you don't have Anton. Kenny, get up here. I'm like, me? And, you know, every second, you know, don't want to waste time. I'm like, yeah, get up here now. So I go running up there. He says, okay, Kenny, you understand? He's going to do a handstand. You're going to tie the yo-yo to his foot. I'm like, okay. And I'm like, I am center stage, David Letterman show. And the guy goes up, and his feet are moving all over the place. And Dave's trying to get the yo-yo on. I'm like, I'm trying, but his foot, I couldn't get every time I try to tie it, his foot go flying. So finally I get it tied. And Dave says, go back and hit a snare roll for me. It was so embarrassing.
But how fun. I mean, what a great experience. And, you know, shortly thereafter, you came in studio. I think it was around New Year's. It was for a New Year's show you played that I went to. And you and Kurt from the Bodines came in the studio and you hung out here. And it was just a couple months later, I think, that came the Beatles, The Night That Changed America. And I swear, I just turned it on for just a few seconds and I'm sitting in the chair and, you know, I'm almost 50, so I need glasses sometimes. And I'm looking at him like, that's Kenny. That's him on stage. And I walked right up to the set and I was like, oh my God. How surreal was that, coming full circle to playing with Ringo and Paul?
Oh, man. Well, first of all, I had to not think about it too much.
Yeah.
I focused on doing my job. I didn't want to mess up there. For every lick I play, I mean, Ringo's playing, so... You know, I was trying to be very, very accurate and respectful to him. So basically, in between every, they would set the stage for the next artist, I was practicing the count off with a click track and everything. Just literally, I got this thing I called RPS, repetition is the preparation for success, repeating anything over and over and over again. It's a repetition. It's that repetition of that thing is the preparation for success. So I was repeating over and over and over again the count off, the first beat, the first fill, so that when they said go, I was already in the groove and in the pocket, and I made no mistakes, and it was fantastic, you know. And then afterwards, that's when I flipped out and had incredible conversations with Paul and Ringo, and I just couldn't believe it. It was like a lifelong dream came true.
Well, and you got to play also, wasn't Stevie Wonder, Alicia Keys, John Legend, Keith Urban, mm-hmm. Pharrell Williams, Joe Walsh, Dave Grohl. Mm-hmm. I mean, all on stage. That night was one of the biggest nights in music, watching that performance.
That's how I felt.
Yeah.
Man. I felt like that. There's a picture, there's a shot of Ringo air drumming to a fill. The only way I knew that fill existed was Don was a producer. Somehow got me tracks of Ringo's drum parts separated from the rest of the music. It was something. The song's called Something. Something in the way of da 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 two. Rack time, floor time. I didn't know what you hear it on the record. It's like, what's he doing? Is it duck it, duck it, or six tuplets, what? But when I heard that by itself, I heard it, and when I did it, there's Ringo smiling at me on TV, mimicking that role.
Iconic drummer Kenny Aronoff. And for more on Kenny, visit Kenny Aronoff, ARONOFF.com. We'll be right back.